Hello and welcome to Arena, coming to you from the Galway International Arts Festival. We're here in the Festival Gallery in what was at one time the Galway Telephone Exchange, and before that, a 1,000-seater venue, the Old Empire Cinema. But for the duration of the festival, it is the home to the exhibition In the Flesh, the sculptures of Sam Jinks, modern take on celestial beings with reimagined versions of Michelangelo's Pieta and Raphael's Deposition. And those and other works being examined today by quite a large audience. In fact, I'm told somewhere upwards of 2,000 people coming in and out of the venue on a daily basis since the festival opened. By the way, we are filming this event, so you can see us on rte.ie/culture. And if you're looking now, I'm looking at you. And you can also check out rte.ie/arena. Standing beside me is Paul Fahey, director of the festival. Paul, In the Flesh is the title of this Sam Jinks exhibition. You know, sometimes when people say, oh, they're so lifelike, you know, I say, it doesn't matter. The lifelike thing isn't necessarily an important thing in terms of sculpture. But in the case of these Sam Jinks sculptures, there's a kind of an eeriness to the lifelike. I'm looking specifically at the Pieta, which is a young man in a jacket holding an older naked man in that Pieta style. And I'm waiting for the younger man in his jacket to open his eyes at any moment in time. It's that lifelike.
They are incredibly real, and some people do refer to the work of Sam Jinks as being hyper-real, but it's actually kind of a term that he's not overly fond of himself. And as you said in your introduction, they are an interesting take or an interesting nod to a lot of the kind of celestial art, and the two pieces in particular, the Deposition and Pieta, Michelangelo and Raphael, are extraordinary takes and reimaginings, if you like, or inspirations of those kind of works. But I think what's really, truly extraordinary about these particular works is that there's a fragility about them and like a deep kind of humanity. They're deeply affecting, and it's very interesting watching people observe them. And there's kind of a quietness a lot of the time, about even though the gallery's been packed, but there's been a quietness as people are observing. And I think because they're so human, I think people are much quicker than you would do, say, with a Raphael or with Michelangelo, are putting themselves in the position of the figure. And, you know, and we've all, well, a lot of people probably have held an older person, be it a parent or whoever, who might be, you know, drawing last breath or has been ill and needs comfort. So I think that happens. So that there's a deep, deep, deep connection that happens. But what's really interesting is the way he kind of plays in it. Like in the Deposition piece, you've got this, you know, beautiful older female figure comforting the younger, presumably it's a younger son. And you'd imagine in a way that it almost should be the other way around. That it's the younger child comforting an older parent. But it's great to see how that kind of play on maybe on strength and fragility. And while the person is the older figure, they still have this history and strength about them. So they are incredible.
I would also urge people to look at the twin babies who are tiny and literally look as if they've come out of the womb in the last half hour, and they're that lifelike. The other one is the kind of inner sanctum of the gallery, if you like, of this pop-up gallery, the big angel that's inside. Again, it's a female figure. I'm expecting her to open her eyes, run, and take off flying at any moment.
It's an incredible piece of work and an incredible room. And indeed, the whole space was transformed. It took us 10 weeks to transform it. It was in rack and ruin when we got the building. And I think our production team, led by Adam Fitzsimons, have done a really terrific job. But the piece you refer to is the messenger. And that figure, again, a nod to us, was the way angels appear in a lot of celestial art and secular art. But the figure is kind of inspired by Iris, who was a messenger god. And the Iris figure, historically stood on the Pantheon in Greece, and Iris was able to move between the living world and the underworld and brought messages from the living to the other world. So she stands in a very kind of contemplative, reflective way, with these amazing, huge 24-carat gold wings flying above, with this very long, 36-foot-long infinity pool, and she's looking into, is she looking into the future? Is she looking into her history, to her memory, to the myth? It's an extraordinary installation.
Also behind us, right here, are Hun Hur Tu. Will you explain who these gentlemen are, and then we can just hear what they can do?
Well, speaking of extraordinary, we were thrilled to have Hun Hur Tu as our guests for the last two nights at the Roisin Dove, and they really are incredible. The sound that they make is sort of like a throat-style singing, but they also have some traditional instruments, and they're from the border of Mongolia and Russia. So please give a very warm welcome to the amazing Hun Hur Tu.
And a track called Irbek Aksi. Yeah. And that was Hun Hur 2 with a track called Irbek Axi. And among the sounds you heard there, the Dosh Pulur and the Bazanchi, which are bowed instruments. You also heard an Igil, which is a plucked instrument, a Tuvan jaw harp, and obviously the throat singing that was at the very centre of it all. And you can hear more from Hun Hur 2. They'll be performing before the end of tonight's programme. But now, we're seated in the midst of the festival gallery, still surrounded by those sculptures of Sam Jinks. In fact, at this point, directly behind us is Medusa Beloved. I'm not sure whether she's looking down on us with kindness or whether it's a kind of a warning as to what I say or don't say over the next hour or so. We'll see as time goes on. And joining me here, as part of the Galway International Arts Festival, Druid Show is Epiphany, a new play by Brian Watkins. Little nod to James Joyce, it must be said. Brian is here with actor Rory Nolan, and also artists Alice Marr and Aidan Barry, who have worked together on a new film piece which is called Six Skin. Brian, the Druid Theatre production this year's Galway International Arts Festival, Epiphany, a new play from yourself. The first in Druid's programme of new writing for 2019. We're on the outskirts, I suppose, of an unnamed city. I don't think it's ever identified as a specific place, Brian. We are quite definitely on the night of the 6th of January, the Feast of the Epiphany, to those who know the Christian calendar, the day the wise men went to visit the Christ child in the manger. And we're at a party in a house owned by a woman called Kate Morgan. All sounds very like the dead. They're waiting on a character called Gabriel to arrive. So what's the, would you say, the relationship between the story you're telling and James Joyce's The Dead? Because it's a big one.
Sure, yeah. It's more of a scaffolding than anything else. I think it's inspired by, not an adaptation of, but certainly inspired by. And it came to me as I was working on another play with Druid. I was reading Dubliners, and this image of the staircase, of this in-between space in that story in particular of The Dead, really stuck with me. Play came to me very quickly.
In fact, am I right in thinking that yeah, the staircase is vital to the action of the play because the people come in from down come up from downstairs
into
the room where the party's happening. But you were out walking in the snow.
Yes.
When the actual idea for the play came to you.
That's right.
Which is central to The Dead as well.
Yeah, absolutely. There's kind of this strange alchemy of inspiration that occurred, and And I wrote the play quite quickly, and Gary Hines had asked me, what else are you writing, what else are you working on? And I told her I'd written this play, and she asked if she could read it, the first draft, and I said, no, it's just a first draft, you don't want to read that. And then she said, please, I know how to read first drafts. So I sent it along, and a few months later we were into talking about production, but that staircases that have quickly, always been...
That quickly you were talking about production?
Yeah, it was unusually fast. And I came out here and read it with Druid in August, and then we did a little workshop of it in January, and here we are today.
And you say that the staircase is vital to the whole idea. Is it this, that in-between nature of a staircase? If you're on the staircase, you're neither, as Kermit the Frog says, you're neither up nor down, you can only be halfway up.
Yeah, that's right. There's something about the play existing in this liminal space. I think all the characters are feeling sort of dislocated, as it were, and sort of stuck in the in-between. And so the staircases kind of provide a nice scaffolding kind of given by James Joyce where epiphanies may or may not occur.
Now, the Feast of the Epiphany is, as I say, it is that moment when the three wise men went to visit the Christ child. But also in this country, the Epiphany is, or the 6th of January, is Iha Nulag na Mann, Women's Christmas or sure. Little Christmas Day. How does that feed in, or does it feed into the story that you're telling?
Well, what's funny about the play is that none of them know what exactly they are trying to celebrate. They know very little about what they've gathered for, and they're sort of trying to reignite this very forgotten tradition, and so they're grasping for any little bits of truth that they can find to kind of come up with this evening or morkin that is very meaningful. So there's little little nods to all the variations of what Epiphany has been, you know, over the course of time. But
and Rory, the character that you play is a man called Taylor. One thing I do know about him is that he likes Merlot. He's very fond of Merlot.
He likes Merlot, yeah, and he's pretty put out when he discovers that they want to put Merlot over an injury. You have to come and see the show to make any sense.
Obviously, the alcohol would
exactly,
avoid infection.
Yeah. And he's in marketing as well. But he's part of this tapestry of characters that Brian has created in the play. It's a wonderful ensemble piece for us. It's very exacting, which makes it very exciting because, you know, it's hard to do. So when it pulls off, it's fantastic. But these characters, like Brian was saying, are all here to celebrate something that they're not really sure what it means anymore, which is kind of, there's a kind of a lovely little irony there, especially in this country, like you were saying, Iha Nulag na Mann and Epiphany and Little Christmas. These people arrive, and they're very modern, they're very international, they're, you know, they're the mobile phone generation, and the idea of communication between them, you know, it kind of breaks down all the time, and how they interact and how we interact with each other. So it's a fascinating piece for us to do in Druid.
That mobile phone aspect of the story, I'm wondering how important that was to you, Brian, because the guests are all asked to put their devices into a box so that they can't be Googling things and checking things out and watching, looking at texts underneath the table while they're supposed to be eating their dinner. To what extent were you looking at this idea of a ritual, perhaps a ritual that's a ritualization that's kind of been lost in a society where our eyes are stuck on our phones or our devices, and we're in our own little world, we're not in a communal world?
Sure, yeah, a ritual that's been lost, and also an experiment with how deep our true knowledge goes, I think. How much can we actually know without our phones, I think. You know, when you remove that immediate source of Google or of any immediate communication, what are we left with? And I've always felt the play, in a very simple way, asked that question about what really brings people together, what, you know, face to face. And the theater seems to be a nice place for that.
Let me actually open it up to both Alice Marr and Aideen Barry, who are with us at the moment. Do you, every dinner party you go to, Alice Marr, does your phone go straight into a box? Do you turn it off and forget about all communications from the outside world?
No.
You're an ordinary, like the rest of us.
Yeah. Like, it's come and go, you know, with us. But in fact, listen to you, it's interesting because the mobile phone has played a part in the film that we have. And Aideen has used the mobile phone to take imagery with a macro lens. And that has gone to be one of the backgrounds, you know, in our film. So we're using it as a media and material as well. So to us, it's just another medium.
But you're using the phone there, not necessarily in that social media sense. No, it's a different thing.
Well, in social media, and part of our collaboration was sending each other back and forth imagery, sounds, performances. So, yeah, it played a part in our collaboration.
It's also like a third eye, you know, and an extension of the self. And actually, I kind of see my own mobile phone as my liver. You know, it processes things and regurgitates things back to you over and over again and renews itself with its new app update and things like that. You can't move away from technology. It all becomes a part of who we are.
It would be easy, Brian, just to demonize the mobile phone and to demonize the potential communication that can take part, you know, if you have your mobile phones. What were you specifically exploring in terms of that communication? Because it's seven people, eight people sitting around a dinner table with nothing but themselves.
Yeah.
That's the only tool they have.
Yeah, it's true. I think it's really exploring why we get together for dinners, why we get together, you know, for celebrations. Who are we as a people if we're celebrating this or that, and what does it mean? But also, you know, all the characters have these qualifiers of I'm not anti-progress, I'm not anti-technology, and they want to be sure that they're kind of, you know, with it at the same time as being in the game of this epiphany dinner. But
one of the tasks that's put out there for the actors, I was speaking to you before we came to air about this, Rory, it's the nature of the overlapping dialogue that you have written, Brian. It's very difficult. I mean, often in overlapping dialogue, it's two characters overlapping, but this is where you have seven people at a dinner party, unlike a radio program. People don't necessarily wait until the question ends. They just jump in and they can have four or five people speaking at the one time. That's difficult stuff.
It's really difficult and a real technical challenge for an ensemble. But we had to be, I mean, the exactitude that we had to go through the script with was kind of breathtaking. And Gary, one of Gary's jobs as director was to kind of police that slightly.
Gary Hines directing, yeah.
If Brian would write a slash, which meant that the next character comes in on that line while that line's been spoken out. And if you get the rhythm wrong, if you come in at the wrong part, you know, if you come in the wrong syllable or the wrong word, then the rhythm is thrown out and the sense and the humour, because the play is actually very, very funny as well. So it was, it was more exacting than doing Waiting for Godot by Beckett, which is very, you know, that script tells you exactly what it wants you to do. This one is like Beckett on steroids. It was, you know, we couldn't let it slip once, otherwise the whole thing kind of sags. So yeah, it was a challenge, but a great one.
The obvious comparisons here and nods are towards Joyce. But Beckett did strike me as well, you know, this could be called, or part of it could be called Waiting for Gabriel. Now, you don't have to say whether Gabriel turns up or not. That's up to you to make that decision. But was Beckett, do you think does he inform your writing in some way?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like all the Druid writers that have that these guys have been working on so brilliantly for so long, I mean, Beckett was a huge source there in this sort of unnamed place that's simply about the people that are within it, as opposed to some definite. There's these existential shades in the play that I think are my nods to him in a certain way. But Tom Murphy, Enda Walsh, Beckett, Joyce, all of these great writers that Druid has explored so many of that have influenced it.
Yeah, and if the lads have to contend with overlapping dialogue, you might explain how in the film that yourself and Aideen have made together, Alice Marr, Six Skin is the name of the film.
Yes.
It starts with tongues, in fact.
Yes.
Do they join up? Do they interlink? And it's not a kiss. It's a very different type of connection that's made between these two tongues.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it doesn't start with those. I mean, the whole premise for the film is like, it starts with a kind of medieval idea of this tapestry. It's interesting to hear you refer to the play as a tapestry of words. So there we are looking at this tapestry, medieval tapestry, and trying to create a film that weaves in and out of itself. So the tongues would be all part of that. Mm. We are interested in the external body, the internal body, the doubled body, because we have twins in the film. They're identical twins, but they're also dancers. So it's like they have the same language, perhaps. But you go inside their bodies, you come outside their bodies, like they're exploring all the different senses through this kind of tapestry and type of film.
And the twins are, it's Jessica and...
Megan Kennedy from Junk Ensemble, yeah. Just
when you arrived in here today then, Aideen, and you look directly across from us at the twin babies, I don't know if you've seen that sculpture.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary how things kind of coalesce in a way
it's funny,
you never expect.
We were looking a lot as well at the idea of twins in utero, so it's kind of interesting that tying up between Sam Jinx. Twins in utero actually can share their DNA, so it kind of goes back to antiquity. So there's a lot of antiquity in presence in this show here, but they're chimeras, and they can often become conjoined. So we were using the notion of conjoining as a type of tapestry or motif through the work as well.
I think, you couldn't call her an absent twin, but there is a sense of the missing, isn't it? Julia is the sister of Kate Morgan, who in this manifestation of, it's well beyond the Joyce story in terms of Julia is no longer there. How important is that absence? And in fact, how important is absence, would you say, in the play itself, Brian?
Yeah, I think it's a lot about people struggling with absence, with void, with loss. There's a line where Morgan says she feels just, the world feels remarkably wobbly, like she feels dislocated, like she feels exiled almost. And I think it's that sense of how do you live in a world that at once doesn't feel hospitable, and yet you are here for however long you're here for. And then, of course, the other side of that coin is that we're all going to die. And there's this very grim end to it. So how do we negotiate those things? And seeing someone like Morgan, Marie Mullen plays Morgan, and she just is putting on quite a performance as a woman that goes through, the play is one scene, and over the course of those hour 45 minutes, she goes through quite a bit, and it's dealing with those absences or voids or a sense of a dislocated world, as it were.
Yeah, and that communication that takes place between the two twins, it struck me from watching the film, it's almost as if they become a single entity. I don't know if that was part of the plan behind it.
We certainly were playing with that whole idea of double identity and double entity, and they are identical twins, but the number of people that have said to us they think they're the same person and that we have actually just copied them, but not so. So we are playing with that whole idea of singularity and identity.
But you also, there's a different, another point where it struck me, Aideen, that the film starts to grow, that you have the two young women, then it becomes almost, they become doubled and doubled again, like a kaleidoscope again.
Yes,
did somebody already use the term kaleidoscopic?
I think it was kind of interesting hearing Brian and Rory talking about the in-between space. We were looking at in-betweens in a lot of the ways that we constructed the imagery, so kaleidoscopic, weaving,
blending,
moving lenses.
Yeah, all those words.
Yes. Yeah. Totally. In the same way that a waft and a weave is constructed on a loom, that's exactly how we approached the making of this.
And talk to me a little bit about the hats that Megan and Jessica wear later on in the film.
Yes, that hat was made by Lena Steen, who's a milliner in Westport, and she based her design on the Tower of Babel, so which is, of course, the classic building of language. So we were thinking about language, Bruegel's painting, the Tower of Babel. So that's where we got the image for that, and the spinning. You see them spinning in it, and of course you spin and weave a tapestry. So everything is kind of related, even the words, the images, and the dances in it. And the sound by David Stalling, who's a composer living in Ireland, German composer living in Ireland, he recorded sound and rewove it over itself back and forth as well. So everything in the film refers to weaving and to cloth.
They actually constructed these specially contact mics that he welded up himself, and the dancers wore them as they danced, so you got the cracking of the knuckles, and he took that sound and he changed that and made that a soundscape. It's an incredible accomplishment.
The way you're both speaking there, you are speaking like Brian and Rory might speak in terms of making a piece of theatre. It struck me that the collaboration between the two of you, and there are, as you said, there are others involved here as well, not least of whom are Junk Ensemble and David Stalling, David Stalling, as you mentioned, who's the sound designer. Is that type of collaboration more unusual in the artist's world, in the visual artist's world, to grow it out like that, or is it quite a common thing now?
I don't know if it's quite a common thing now, but certainly there would have to be a starting point where you'd have a lot in common. You know what I mean? That you wouldn't just throw anybody together with anybody. So we had started together, somebody invited us to do a job together, which was curating a show for Ormston House in Limerick. And through our choice of the work, and even our title for the show, which was called Undertow, we kind of discovered in each other's work that undertow that both of us were attracted to, you know, and we just thought, like, why don't we get together and make a bigger work together, you know, make a collaboration together, because we had a lot in common already, we thought. And, you know, our sense of humour was kind of similar. So
Pickettian, actually, almost as well, this kind of slapstick thing,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, kind of sting in the tail kind of humour. Yeah. So, so we wanted, we pooled our resources, really, to make a bigger piece.
And did, in fact, that bigger aspect that you're talking about, did scale come into this in a way that perhaps neither of you have worked on? Because it's 13, 14 minutes long, but there's so much going on. There must be so much to actually get that 13, 14 minutes together.
Massive. And in terms of even going out to some place like Teleguail, working with a producer, things like that, working with an editor, the whole hierarchy of that was completely different.
That our main collaborator, as the thing went on, was the editor, because of course we had fortunes of footage, you know, and we had to kind of weave that together. So she became like the main weaver. That's Connie Farrell. So I learned a lot actually through that about editing being the major part of film.
Undertow is an interesting term, because I've been trying to define the relationship between James Joyce's The Dead and your play, Brian, Epiphany. Undertow actually is, there's an undertow of Joyce in there. That's kind of what it is in some ways, isn't it?
Oh, sure, absolutely. I mean, he's certainly haunted the piece in an amazing way. And my inspiration for it has always been more emotional than academic. And I think that's an attribution to what we've all found in exploring Joyce through the book and through what the play is doing now. But
and that collaborative aspect, Rory, who is it Gary who ultimately calls the shots when it comes to the end of that process?
I'm going to say
Gary
yes.
Is Gary the editor?
Yeah, well, she was certainly the whip cracker. No, she was, of course, yeah. She's at the helm of it all. It was a joy to have Brian there for huge parts of the rehearsal. And, you know, like all theatre, it was a big collaborative effort with the ensemble and with the crew and with the stage management, like everything we do. So it's been a great joy, really, and I hope people come and just enjoy it as much as we've enjoyed putting it together.
Yeah, you've the small matter of a preview to prepare for. You did two previews in Dunleary,
the
Pavilion Theatre, and now
a final one tonight. Then and we open tomorrow. Yeah, officially. So Dunleary was great. You know, dip the toe in the water with it and see what we had on our plates. And of course, with playing in the Town Hall, we're not in the MLT, the McLally Theatre, where we usually would play, which was being used for the FLA, so we needed to get it up on its feet before we came down here to Galway. But it is now firmly in the Town Hall, in its, you know, where it was designed to be, and it's great to be there.
And I guess that theatre, that size of that theatre, you and your staircase, Brian, you wouldn't be able to cope with a smaller staircase than you have, would you?
That's right, yeah. The two staircases, we kind of need that size.
Okay. Well, as Rory and Brian were telling us there, Epiphany, which is the Druid production for the Galway International Arts Festival, final preview at the Town Hall Theatre in Galway this evening, and then it runs through until the 27th of July. And Six Skin, we'll be able to see it throughout the run of the festival,
Alice? Throughout the festival from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. every day, and late night, I think, on Thursday.
On Friday, yeah.
Friday.
Yeah.
And it's free, just to let everybody know. Yeah. And not only, like, it's in the NUIG, O'Donoghue Centre, but there are a number of other exhibitions there as well. So if you go over there, all those exhibitions are free. Anne-Lynn Chow,
Sarah Hutchison,
Sarah Hickson, and Edna Walsh has a piece
and
over
there.
There you go.
It's all coming together perfectly. Theatre and the visual arts. Well, that's what happens at the Galway International Arts Festival, isn't it? So thanks very much to the first of my four guests this evening. Six Skin, as Alice was telling us there, Aideen Barry and Alice Maher. It's at the O'Donoghue Centre in NUI, Galway. We better let Brian and Rory get off to deal with final preview. Best of luck with that. And we'll be back with more from the Festival Gallery after this break.
And welcome back to the Festival Gallery Arena, coming to you this evening from the Galway International Arts Festival. Artists Alice Marr and Aidan Barry are still with me. We'll continue talking about Six Skin, the film piece that they've made, the video piece that they've made together. But also joining us on in the Festival Gallery at this point is the director, Mike Shepherd, whose show Dead Ducks in a Suitcase and Other Love Stories, based on John Gay's Beggar's Opera, is on at the Black Box Theatre in Galway as part of the festival. And Brendan DeGalley, choreographer and dancer, artistic director of Eru, with a dance version, Osgaeliga as well, of Oscar Wilde's Salome. So a lot going on there, not to mention the Seagulls of Galway, who are very much part of this evening's performance here at Arena. That's what you're hearing. So we're not pretending we're in Galway. We don't have a sound effect of seagulls outside. We are actually here. Let's go back to yourself, Mike, and Nihai, your company based in Cornwall. Huge hit in Galway when you came here in 2017 with your production of Tristan and Isolde. And then you give us this very easy title, Dead Dog in a Suitcase and Other Love Songs. It started with John Gay, did it? Yep. And the Beggar's Opera. So how did that become Dead Dog in a Suitcase, brackets, and Other Love Songs?
This is going to be a slightly convoluted answer.
Okay.
Charles Hazlewood initially brought the Beggar's Opera to us, and I didn't like it. I didn't know who McHeath was. He was a womanizer. He was a rogue. And the women were prostitutes. And I thought, well, I'm not interested in this nowadays. Although it was brilliant that John Gay was reacting to the kind of the class system and
in the obsession, 18th century,
with Italian opera. And he collected all those dirty ditties from the street and made an opera for the beggars of the street, which, as somebody who is, actually, I've toured endlessly theatre, and I've been shocked at the state of our English cities in the last 3 years, the number of homeless on the streets. So that became very pertinent to me. Then I'm from Cornwall, where we've got seagulls as well. And we voted UKIP. And then we voted Brexit. And do you know what I did? I went through my old CD collection and I found a copy of The Clash. And I put it on really loud, Know Your Rights, and I hammered up the motorway. And I very rarely go back to Cornwall now. I was so shocked and disappointed by that. And Nihai's been going for 40 years. And obviously in that time, it's a worldwide thing. We've seen the kind of reduction of the community, and we always used to play to the community. I started Nihai 40 years ago because I didn't want to play in theatres. I didn't want to play to theatre goers. I wanted to play to people, to families, to communities, and where the Red River met the sea at Gadrevi, or in the old arsenic waste at Gunnislake, or the gunpowder factory at Kennel Vale. So we came from that tradition, and I guess I got a bit lost. So the notion now that I might retire in Cornwall was the opposite. So the next thing I did, I went to the Calais jungle and I took a Nihai team there for a week. And all this started fueling everything. And then I read Thrupney Opera, and there was one sentence from Brecht. I'm not sure, am I allowed to say the word S-H-I-T on Irish radio?
Well, you've kind of spelled it for us now, right, so you might as well. If you're going to spell it out, you better say it out.
I better say it. So I read that sentence, the world is poor and man's a shit, and I thought, oh, let's return to that story of the Beggar's Opera. But I wanted to let people know that we weren't just doing a new version of the Beggar's Opera, we were doing something different, because there's a lot of, I'm going to use the word again, there's a lot of bullshit about how we develop new audiences and attract other audiences. And for very good reason, myself and Carl Groves called it Dead Dog in a Suitcase and Other Love Songs, because we wanted to attract a different audience. So absolutely, the marketing departments in theatres threw their hands up in horror and said, oh, can't you call it something else? And it has attracted a different audience.
I'm wondering, though, I'm interested that you do mention Brecht's the Thrupney Opera there, which was his version, himself and Kurt Weill, their version of the John Gay, the 18th century opera.
you went right back to the 18th century source. So it's not that you skipped over Brecht, but you wanted to go back to John Gay itself. What was it about the older version that kind of opened it up for you for what you wanted to say, all those political statements you wanted to make?
I think that notion of popular songs and dirty ditties and the brilliance of Charles Hazlewood. I don't know if you know about him, but he's for a start, he created the Power Orchestra. He'll also work with a 30 guitar orchestra. He'll work in South Africa with massive choirs. So I was really interested in the score that he was going to base it on kind of popular music of now. So we kind of charted the story through the music, and then quite often I find in my process that the things I don't like are the things that spurs me onwards. So I mentioned McHeath, who was a womanizer. So one of the first decisions I made was, right, there's going to be a load of babies in it. His kids, there's going to be women demanding maintenance. So there's a chorus of babies in it for a start. And then I didn't know what McHeath was in Threepenny Opera. I didn't really know what he did in All Beggars Opera. So we've made him a contract killer as well. So
in no doubt that he's a nasty bit of work when he wants to, when he wants to be. Interesting that Mike brings up there that idea, Alice Marr, of, you know, bringing theatre maybe to places that it's not usually brought to. How big a challenge is that for the visual artist, you know, to bring work into situations where it's not seen as, oh, well, that's not for me, I won't understand it, or I don't know the language that's involved here?
Do you mean for the audience or for the artist?
For the artist, to what extent do you have to think about the audience? Do you think, I want to bring this to a new place, or I want to open my work out to a new audience?
I think our wish to make this a film, you know, for a CineScope size film, was to reach another audience of people that wouldn't necessarily come into a gallery, because we would be basically gallery artists, and we'd show in galleries or museums and stuff like that. But, you know, to have something showing in a cinema or in a festival like this might be a different experience for us, and we would attract. And also, I think both of us are fairly interested in the audience accessing your work at different levels.
Yeah.
You know, you could access it at the level of dance, for instance. You could access it at the level of color and fantasy. You know, you could access it at the level of language. You could access it at the level of agency. Like, there's so many different doors into it. Mm. And both of us would have always been very interested in sourcing all different audiences.
Yeah. New audiences.
For visual arts.
And are you, Brendan, you know, I've said that you're giving us an Irish language and dance version of Oscar Wilde's Salome, a very rich tale linguistically, as he wrote it originally in Irish. Were you trying to access something new in that work?
Well, initially the use of text, because I've been moving in that direction for a certain amount of time, but I also am directing along with Joe Byrne, and he uses me as a choreographer, and he uses a lot of physicality with his actors, and I find that really intriguing. So I was trying to find that common ground between being able to present something with all the art forms coming together in terms of the visual art, the text, and the movement, so that there's no sense of there's a dance number and a piece of text, that they're all interwoven, to use your word from earlier on, Alice. There's a lot of that weaving happening, but also the Irish language being a native speaker. I was really intrigued by how it might sound, because there's a lot of it's very poetic, it's very repetitive, and again we access the repetitive nature, and we kind of like reference that in the movement style and in the choreography. But it was really very much about how Oscar Wilde's work would sound in Irish, and it's quite beautiful.
I'll come back to you a little bit of that later in the program, but just as we finish up with you, Mike, Knee High, I suppose, bring all of those aspects together, because this isn't just a play, it isn't just a music. There's a lot goes on stage from what I've seen of video versions of the production.
Yeah, my base level, and this is going to sound flippant, is it's not boring. Theatre shouldn't be boring, and my early experiences of it often was boring. So there is a lot going on, but it is because of that. The roots of the company really were working on those cliff tops and in those extraordinary places. So you are telling the story through action, through dance, through music, through metaphor, rather than just a chatty script.
All there. So the show that Mike Shepherd has been talking to us about is called Dead Dog in a Suitcase, and other love songs. It runs at the Bailey Allen Hall in NUIG, right beside Alison 18. In fact, you can go to the both now. Yes. You can go to all of everything out in NUIG if you so wish. It's there until the 27th of July. And once again, full details for everything there on the website, which is giaf.ie. Back with more after this break. And welcome back to Galway and the Galway International Arts Festival Arena, coming to you this evening from the Festival Gallery. Still with me, Alice Marr. Brendan Galley is here as well to talk further about, I was going to say Redemption Falls, exactly why, you'll find out why I said that in a minute, to talk more about Oscar Wilde's Salome. But the reason I'm talking about it, Redemption Falls, is that it is the Joseph O'Connor novel, but there's also a theatre production happening at Antiviarc as part of the Galway International Arts Festival. It's part of a co-production from Moonfish Theatre, Galway International Arts Festival, and the Abbey Theatre in association with the Town Hall Theatre. And indeed, Moonfish also produced a much-loved adaptation of another Joseph O'Connor story, Star of the Sea, here in 2014. Grace Kiley and Pat Hargan are with us now to play, from this version of Redemption Falls, the Ballad of Redemption Falls.
My friends, you ask the question why I'm so sad and blue. It's all because I'm thinking of wars and what they do. Draw in your pony closer, a tale to you I'll tell, all about Redemption Falls and how redemption fell. Now poor young Jed O'Mooney, the rebel soldier child, without a hand to guide him, was lost and running wild. They called him crazy Jed O when he beat his homemade drum. Things of which he could not speak had left this killer dumb. But for all those ugly portraits, there's one who knew him true. Said he sang just like an angel, that boy from Baton Rouge. And some they calls him Jado, some it's Jado Wild. What wrongs we wrought, what sins we taught, to raise a devil's child. Well, the boy, he had a sister out of Baton Rouge, she'd come. A bag of tunes gone walking to find Jeddo and his drum. She walked for nearly 2 long years, determined for to find the only living blood she had, and he the devil's child. Well, you may have heard the legends of the man they call the Blade. Brave O'Keefe, the general of a bold Irish brigade. Some say he was a patriot, some say an Irish ape.
To garnish the wild mountain lands was his inglorious fate.
There we have it, the Ballad of Redemption Falls, performed for us there by Grace Kiley and Pat Hargan, and that production of Redemption Falls at Tyberg na Gaillimhe from the 24th through until the 28th of July, and you'll find out full details on giaf.ie. I think I rather rudely said that Alice Marr was here still and didn't say that Aidan Barry was here still. You are still here,
I'm
Aidan.
I'm still here, Sean.
So thank you for staying with us. And as I said, I want to talk to Brendan the Galley now a little bit more about his production of Oscar Wilde's Salome. Tán Gaeilge o Gúcas.
Tá.
So is it automatic for you that you would just say, no, it's there in Merla, but it's my lum go meach sean in Gaeilge freshen?
Yeah, sean's my. It's very hard. Sometimes the motivation to do something isn't always very clear. It tends to be these seminal moments when you're younger, and one of the big moments for me was seeing the Gate production in the late 80s when I went to college first, and I was really moved by how it was done in such an experimental way. But also we did it at a school, and we did an Irish version, and And I just felt as a dancer that there was the opportunity there to do it with dance. But my practice, well, what I was thinking about in those days has changed dramatically over those many, many years in the meantime. Mm. But it was about the movement that I heard in the words and the imagery that I heard in the words and the fact that my Irish dancing practice is changing very, very dramatically. So although I like to work with Irish dancing bodies, we don't dance like the traditional Irish dancer. Yet it is very important that we are Irish dancers, though.
Yeah, because people could... they can see you now, actually, if they bother to log on to rte.ie/culture or rte.ie/arena. They will see you, but... people who are looking at you now will know your face from Riverdance. Mm. So is that as much Irish dance, Riverdance, as what you're doing now with Salome, do you think?
Well, what I'm doing wouldn't... Well, I heard a person review it in Roddy and the Galtarta, and it was very... She didn't describe it as Irish dance at all. So the impulse, the tubber, the well is still Irish dance and how those bodies are, but we don't... A lot of the canons of the Irish dance tradition we don't kind of adhere to. It is, I suppose, about the movement quality, our kind of understanding of rhythm, our kind of loyalty to music, how music inspires the body to move. And again, my practice is moving very much outside the traditional Irish dance aesthetic. But again, you know, our dance in this is also informed by the imagery, the words, and how we kind of deliver the text and the rhythm of the text. So that became part of the palette, that became what it is that you see on stage.
To what extent did dance become another language alongside Oscar Wilde's English, your own Irish or the Irish translation, and then dance being a totally different language to express something within the story?
Absolutely. And like in a more literal way, I suppose we had to lose some of the text. We had to edit it back so that there was space for the dance. But, you know, Oscar Wilde was very involved with the movement of aestheticism. So again, there's a lot of the stuff there that is there for the beauty that it is. But again, there's something that movement brings that cannot be done with words or cannot be done with music. And again, how we kind of interact with it or how we interface with it is our very, very unique to our own personal narratives. But I do think we do have a shared cultural understanding. And so I've kind of accessed a lot of, say, religious movements or perhaps kind of Baptist preacher postures. And have those woven through it, as well as whatever was kind of referenced as imagery within the text.
Dance really has informed Aidan in the piece, in your piece with Alice. To what extent did dance start to almost dictate the images that yourself and Alice were creating?
When we were looking at the original tapestries, they had certain postures, and that was one of the
postures
starting
again,
points.
That's an interesting
very
one
much
that you're picking
so,
up on.
Yeah. But also there was also animals present in the postures and flora and fauna. And we went to Jessica and Megan with a kind of a tableau of these themes and also extreme yoga poses to try and create arachnid kind of shapes. And then they took that and they choreographed particular extreme movements. And the dancers behave almost animalistic at points, very uncannily, like spiders in places. So they really rose to the challenge. We just gave them a kind of a plethora of stuff. And they
and of
just
course, their company, Junk Ensemble, are well known for collaboration with all kind, with soldiers, choirs, you know, with all different kinds of groups and people. Mm. So we thought they were the perfect people for us to work with. And of course, them being twins was a big thing for us.
Well, that twin aspect really does add something. But when you take on Oscar Wilde and when you take on Salome, you have to take on the dance of the seven veils, Brendan.
Well,
that's quite a task, isn't it?
That was a big one for me. And the fact that it was a dance piece, it was very important for me to do something very special with the Dance of the Seven Veils. And I thought of it almost as an anti-dance in a sense that I felt that what we find attractive or what turns us on or what we find erotic can be the most subtle of things. So it's a very nuanced dance, and it's about actually it's almost, there's a stillness about it, and that's I think it works brilliantly. But I'm working with an incredible dancer called Sarah Fennell, who plays Salome, and you can throw anything at her and she's absolutely a stunning, stunning performer.
And did you look for, in those who were going to take part in the show, were you looking for dancing bodies or acting bodies, speaking bodies?
Purely dancing bodies who had within them the capacity to try a new challenge. And I've built up this company over about 10 years, and I've encountered people, as Pina Bausch says, I'm more interested in the individual rather than what their training is. And that's what I've collected around me. And I love them as a company.
Alice and Aidan, now that dance has
you know, it's very much at the heart of your current piece.
Yes.
Is it something that you want to explore further now?
Well, I think actually dance is something that has come in contemporaneously into visual art an awful lot. You probably have noticed that too, working with the human body in all its different forms. So it's not even dance almost anymore. It's just like movement of the human body. So certainly, like particularly Nadine's practice, who would have been the performer in her own films earlier on, anyway, in particular. So concerns of the body, you know, is very common to all of our work.
All right. Well, just remind us again where and when the film piece
we're
is working, Nadine.
NUIG in the O'Donoghue Centre. We're open daily from 11 till 6 and open late on Thursday and Fridays.
And Brendan, then Salome.
In Antive York, and we're every night from 7:30. And then we have a matinee on Saturday. And Saturday the 20th is our last day of performances.
All right. Well, congrats and best of luck to everybody who's involved in all of those events and indeed all of those who are speaking to us here on this special arena from the Festival Gallery at the Galway International Arts Festival. Paul Fahey spoke to us earlier, Alice Marr and Aideen Barry, who are still with us, Mike Shepherd, Brendan the Galley, who's here beside me, Pat Hargan and Grace Kiley, who performed from Redemption Falls, which is on as well during the festival, and Rory Nolan and Brian Watkins, who are part of the Druid production. You can watch this programme on the website, rte.ie/culture, or on the Arena webpage, which is rte.ie/arena. Thanks to the Galway International Arts Festival and all the visitors here to the gallery for putting up with us for the last couple of hours. On sound, here in the Festival Gallery, Cian McAvoy and Seamus O'Martha, John Doyle back in the Galway studio. The programme was researched by Paula Shields, Elaine Conlon was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. But we will finish as we started with Hu Hurtu, that wonderful Mongolian group of musicians, and the song that they're going to perform is Chaira Kuv.
Oh,